Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sangkhang namassami. So Buddhist practice is really chiefly about trying to learn about the heart and the mind. And these words, the heart and mind, I use interchangeably. I don't like the word mind so much, it sort of sounds close to intellect. And heart sounds a bit sort of somehow too emotional. So there's not really the right word. Consciousness, perhaps, is fair. So it's this practice is one of learning how to understand the mind, learning to understand how it works, learning to understand how it feels. Learning how to understand its value, its tremendous value. Before we come to meditation practice especially, but or Buddhism in general, or religious spiritual practice in general, it's unavoidable that we treat the mind with real disrespect. And we don't realize that the mind is like a container, and it picks up impressions all day long, night and day. The things it encounters, the intentions that we give rise to, the things we say, the things we do. Everything that we do affects the mind. And the mind is like a continuous stream of causality. It's a continuous stream of psychic components that are conditioned by our intentions. And it's somewhat remarkable that though this is rather obvious, I think, it's never really seems to have been made much of, at least in the Western world. You just think of, for instance, let's say you give rise to an intention. Say you're married. And your spouse is at work, and you think to yourself, you know, I'd like to surprise my wife or my husband, and I'd like to, you know, do something special, whether it's, I don't know, get a gift or create a special meal. You really kind of go out of your way to do something for the person, something that they're not expecting in any way. A total, you know, you're not expecting anything in return, you're just a total act of generosity, something you just give. And it's delightful. You do that and you feel wonderful. Both while you're thinking about it, you feel energized and you're looking forward to it. While you do it, it feels wonderful. Your partner is kind of all surprised and touched. And then afterwards, the mind feels uplifted. The mind feels bright. And that's just a very simple example of how the mind is conditioned by the things that we do. So we, in terms of meditation practice or Buddhist practice in general, that's something we want to really pay meticulous attention to. Because this mind is something that's with us from the moment we're born to the moment we die. And in the various spiritual traditions of the world, it's widely regarded to be something that carries on after death in one form or another. And it's, again, with just a little bit of reflection, it's somewhat obvious, it seems to me anyways, that the way that the mind carries on after death will be parallel to the way it carried on during life. And it doesn't happen through, certainly not coincidence, not by chance. It doesn't happen through the will of some power, some god or anything like that. We land ourselves in conditions, environments, countries, cultures. We land ourselves in situations based on the accumulation of volition, the various choices that we make. Is what, you know, it almost seems like it needn't be said, but it's the various choices that we make is what determines much of our life, how our life unfolds. And I would say, in the Buddhist teachings, in the long run, it's the only determinant that determines our environment and the experience of happiness or suffering that we feel. And if you can reflect on this and really appreciate what that means, a tremendous responsibility that we have to this mind, just how valuable it is. And this is where the meditation practice that we just did moments ago, the samatha, we call it samatha meditation, is so valuable because it opens up to us states of consciousness that just feel enormously valuable. And you start to get a sense for how meaningful and how powerful the mind is in creating its own destiny and creating its own experiences. So this is what Buddhism is really, this is one of the things it really kind of tries to focus on, is trying to teach us and help us learn what the mind is and what influences it in a good way. I think people who are new to Buddhism, we have these conventions and... Again, this is Ajahn Chah would speak about this quite a lot. Like all religions have their conventions. You have by conventions I mean the traditions, the way that you dress when we come together. From the monks wear the robes. We have this outer robe we call a sanghati that we wear to ceremonies. We light two candles. We have a Buddha image. We sit in a certain order. And all of this is just called a convention. In itself, it doesn't mean anything. It's just the way that we do things. And it's sometimes, because it's new and foreign to people, it sometimes can be a bit strange. I remember my mom, when she came to Thailand, and she walks into the sala, the main meditation hall, and she looks at this Buddha image First off, she was horrified because it was golden, and she immediately what came to her mind was some kind of, what is it, the golden golden idols, this kind of image from the Ten Commandments, the movie, where there's these kind of idol worshippers and these kind of golden statues. That was her first thought. And then her second thought, and this one she expresses out loud, she says, "I didn't realize the Buddha was a woman." And she's not a woman, Mom. She says, "Well, he's got breasts." No, Mom, he's a man. It's just the way the statue looks. It's not, doesn't indicate his sex. But it's interesting because, I mean, so much of what kind of colors the mood of say, like right now, it's, you know, the lights are down. Outside, it's a quiet night. The candles are lit. Everyone's sitting quietly. It creates a certain feeling and mood. And it happens to be a mood which is very conducive to turning the mind inwards, to reflecting on our experience. But it's simply a mood. And these conventions could be completely different, and it wouldn't make any effect on the teachings themselves. For instance, we have a convention that when somebody is teaching the Dhamma, he should sit on a higher seat. And that's out of respect to the teachings. He should sit on a higher seat than everybody else. And we could just as easily have the opposite convention. If we lived in a culture where it was rude to be sitting in a higher position than someone else, and it was polite kind of to be sitting on a lower seat, then that's the way we would do it. I mean, it's completely different. So all these conventions that you see in the monastery, they're just that, and they all have the purpose is simply to aim the mind, to help aim the mind in a certain direction, to create an atmosphere, to create a mood that's conducive to those two aspects that I spoke of earlier, tranquility and understanding. So every culture has its conventions, like Western culture, Thai culture, Asian culture, monastic culture, biker culture. Any group of people, when they come together, there's conventions that govern the way that they relate and the way that they do things. And some conventions are well, conventions in themselves are never harmful or inherently harmful or helpful. But the way that they get used can be harmful or can be helpful. So all the conventions that we have, all the conventions that the Buddha laid down, we believe, are encouraging us and aiming us in a certain direction. But that's all they are. I mean, there's the famous image of a finger pointing at the moon. And it's like you have a finger, it's pointing at the moon, it's trying to say, look at that beautiful moon. And you have a finger pointing to it. And then you say, this finger is the most important thing in the world. Because why? Because it's pointing at the moon. And of course, that's not true. I mean, the finger is, you know, it could be your toe. It could be anything, basically. What's important is the moon, not the pointing. So we have, in the monastic culture, we have all kinds of little things that are helping us, encouraging us, and trying to direct us, both objects as well as styles of etiquette and behavior that are all kind of serving similar function as the finger that points at the moon. And just like the finger that points at the moon, I mean, people can choose to ignore the finger. They may not even recognize the finger. They may worship the finger. There's so many different ways that you can relate to that finger. And it may well be for somebody who basically say they just don't get it. They see this finger and they don't quite get how to look at the moon. And well, it might be a very reasonable thing to say, look, if you don't get it now, then just trust me, just take this finger, you know, or whatever this pointing device is, and just hold on to it. And just be with that finger for as long as you need to be. For now, that's the most important thing in your life. That seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to say because they aren't yet ready to be able to turn the head and to understand how to turn the head and look in the direction that the finger is pointing. So the conventions that we have in monasteries, they're many and varied. and if it's really up to us individually to use them for their intended purpose. And Buddhism as such will either flourish or decline depending on how the practitioners, monastic and lay, how well they relate to those conventions. Now, ultimately, I say these fingers are just pointing, trying to point us in a certain direction, but really the direction that we have to, not so much the direction, but the what's really going to make us see the moon, as it were, in this simile, it's going to be our own practice of meditation. And what we just did now, previously, was, like I said, it's called tranquility meditation. And it's a very wonderful meditation, and it's something that that it's hard work, actually. It's quite hard work. The mind, for most of us, is just so insistent. It just so much likes to think. It so much likes to play with thoughts and emotions, and likes to speculate and worry. And so many things that the mind likes to do. It doesn't like to just be still. Even though it's like a sick mind, really, because when it's still, it's happy. When it's still, it's complete. And when it's just kind of looking and kind of restless and kind of going from object to object, just thirsting for some experience to fill it, it's not complete, it's not happy, there's no sense of contentment and completion. So this one aspect of meditation, tranquility meditation, what we're trying to do there is simply trying to acquaint ourselves and our minds on an experiential level with what it would feel like to be at peace. And the reason I say that we do this as a preliminary or as kind of the first part of our meditation practice is because whatever peace we experience in that stillness, even the most refined states, the most deep and refined states that we might experience, they're basically impermanent. They arise and they pass away. And if you get carried away, get excited, you can really become very deluded by by these states because you think, you might think you're special. You might think you're enlightened. There's many different ways you can get deluded by these states. You can very easily get attached to them, and this happens quite often. People have a profound experience, especially when they're starting out, and then they spend the next 10, 15, 20 years trying to recreate that experience, and they just can't get back to it. I've known a number of people who've gone through that. So the samatha states, the states of tranquility and stillness, we develop them as a way to get a perspective on what is possible with consciousness. Normally, say for instance, if our minds are just kind of immersed in sensuality, especially. But sensuality, that includes various forms of activity and kind of, say, exercising power in the world and influence and just the various kinds of happiness that people experience. It's really quite shallow compared to some of the experiences that you can have in meditation. And I just say that I hope that doesn't sound judgmental or anything. I think that's a common experience. And if you haven't had states of stillness as a way of comparing, then you'd never know. You'd never know. Especially with sensuality, just how shabby, what a shabby sort of happiness sensuality is. It's simply something that it's an experience, and it kind of pulls us out into some kind of external world, some external contact, and it often deludes us. We get very excited about it very quickly, and we like it, and it's a wonderful feeling, and then it's gone, and then we want more of it, and then we compete with others to get it, and then you're envious of other people who have more than we have, and very soon we're just kind of immersed in what we call worldliness. And if we contrast that to the happiness that just wells up from within, that's based on just, I don't want anything. I don't need anything. Just sitting here under a tree, just awake. And that kind of happiness has a beauty to it that especially with sensuality, that doesn't exist. But having said that, even say these refined states or say meditative states of consciousness, they still have the same characteristic of even the most coarse kind of sensuality, in the sense that they arise and pass away, and that they arise based on conditions. And in this sense, sensuality can be a good analogy. If you want to have, say, a big house, you want to experience the joys of a big, secure house, or say a nice car or whatever. You have to work. You have to go to work. You have to get a job. Assuming you do it legally, you have to invest. You know, you have to invest time and effort and skill. And then you have to save your money. You have to refrain from spending it for a period of time, long enough that you have this kind of wad of cash that you can then take it down to the store and get your object that you want. And that object was acquired through conditions and kind of hard work and diligence, and then the result was money, and then you bought your object. And it's a bit similar with meditation states. Also, let me just say about that object, once you buy it, you have it, it's great for the first little while. After a while, it gets a bit boring. Later on, it breaks, or you lose it, and then you just wind up throwing it away, and that's the end of it. Okay, not necessarily a waste. I mean, it might have provided you with some nice experiences or what have you. But in the same way, meditative states, they don't have the same, I don't know how to say it without sounding, like, they don't have the same smell. I mean, that doesn't sound very nice, but they don't have the same smell as, say, the sensual happinesses. The meditative states just feel very pure and very clean. But they share that quality, that characteristic of something that arises and passes away. These states of absorption or tranquility, they're not mystical states. They're not like mystical union with some undefined being or some mystical consciousness that somehow is behind, you know, an appearance of illusion. It's not like that. Even these states have this characteristic of contact between awareness and the object. And that contact is there for a while, and then it disperses. And that's why we have to develop a deeper understanding. And that's where contemplation comes in, or investigation. I think maybe I won't say too much about that tonight. Just enough to say that the tranquility is a foundation, and it is like a resting place, and the investigation, we have to investigate, say, the body and the mind. And that's really work, and that's movement. That requires movement of consciousness and directing attention. And as I was saying to somebody today, if investigation, necessarily you have to go into the unknown, or else it's not investigation, it's memory. And whenever you go into the unknown with the purpose of learning, sometimes it leads to confusion and uncertainty, and not really sure how to proceed. And it also leads to fatigue, because it's kind of hard work, because there's movement. And that's why we have to come back to the samatha, to the tranquility. So we develop these two skills. One is to investigate, especially investigating death. What is death? What does it mean? What does it mean to die? What is the relationship between consciousness and this body? Or between consciousness and thought, consciousness and emotion? And these are the sort of things in meditation, when the mind gets calm, this gets easier to do. But like I said, the mind gets tired, and it's natural to get confused. That's natural from time to time. And so when these states arise, confusion, difficulty, fatigue, doubt, one, we have to recognize that those states themselves are impermanent, and they arise and pass away. But then also we have to give ourselves permission to completely pull back and just let go of everything. Just let go of everything and just reconnect with the present moment, with stillness, with tranquility. And we stay there for basically as long as we want. You know, I mean, you just kind of come back, you rest, you relax, you arouse these states of mind. Gratitude is one of the most peaceful and nourishing states that I can think of. faith, again, very, very close for me, very close to gratitude. Just a sense of great confidence in these teachings. And I guess the reason, that's probably why it feels so close, is because I feel that trust, I just naturally feel very grateful to have encountered the teachings. And I did want to say tonight also, just to touch on something I've heard elsewhere in the community, and I just wanted to mention that the spiritual path is one constantly, we always start from the present moment. We start from where we are. And there's no such thing as there's no such thing as a reason to be discouraged. And we always have to be prepared to start over and to just start again, because we do lose, certainly I lose, and I think everyone loses the mindfulness from time to time. They lose that memory, that just how important this is. We lose that perspective, and we have to start over. And then after we start over, then it does happen that we lose it again, and then we have to start over again. Eventually, we get frustrated at having had to start over so many times. So we have to start to be at peace with that frustration. But just keep starting over. There's no end to it. And that's all right. That's not a problem. We just, okay, that's right. You know, blew it again, no problem. Let's just try and learn from it. Okay, right, we blew it again. What is there I can learn from this? How can I adjust my behavior, my relationships, my whatever it is, how can I adjust things so that I can proceed more skillfully? And it, I think also, this is my last point that I was hoping to make tonight. When you first come across the path, you really don't know. You're in your own world, basically. You're in your own world. You don't know, frankly. When you first meet the Dhamma, you haven't met the Dhamma yet. I mean, the Dhamma is, you're just meeting your own understanding of it. You're coming across what you think is the Dhamma. And generally, you kind of hold on to that, and you have a fixed idea as to how it's supposed to be. Usually, you're very inspired at first, and it's really great, and then after a while, it gets a bit more difficult, and maybe a bit dry, and then maybe you start to struggle, and then doubt to rise, and that's natural. That's natural. You can't repress the doubts, because as soon as you start repressing doubt, you close the door to wisdom, because wisdom can only arise through an honest investigation, an honest opening to the things that you're not sure of. If you really doubt something, then maybe there's something there worthy of doubt. You know, maybe that's worth looking into. You have to respect that. And the inspirations, you know, this natural. Inspiration is not a it's not something that can sustain. You can't sustain inspiration. It can't be sustained. And when it comes, it's like a beautiful day. It's like a peaceful. It's like something that just comes, and you have to let it come and let it go. But you have to find the motivation for your practice. It really has to come from somewhere else. And it has to come from something deeper. It has to come from a sort of understanding rather than an emotion. And so to that extent, you know, often, you know, you go through these phases where the inspiration, especially you start off really inspired, you have to let that go. And you have to, don't despair when it leaves you. You can see that as really an opportunity to deepen the foundation, to put your foundation of your practice on more solid ground. And that solid ground is sort of a deeper understanding. It has to be kind of an understanding, not an emotion. So I think I kind of conclude this talk here, and it's been a bit kind of all over the place, but I hope that it's been a benefit to some extent for somebody. I'll leave it there.